Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian Inside podcast number 191. No, we still don't have a theme tune after 191 podcasts. At least we'll get Ewan on it. Ewan Spencer's back from America. Hooray!
Bum, ba-dum, ba-dum, bum, 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 ba-dum, ba-dum. You want the theme tune now, yeah? Bum, ba-dum,
ba-dum, bum, I'd rather have something more professionally produced if it's all the same. But welcome.
That's, what do you mean? That's an a cappella version of Mission Impossible.
Yes, but we want something that's copyright free. Thank you for the effort anyway. We'll probably still get sued just from your a cappella version. Also with us, we have Dan in Sussex, Rafe Blandford.
Hello, everybody.
And of course, we have up in Hull,
David Gilson.
Let's get right into the news, though. Our Obby suite has now been officially replaced. Long live Nokia suite was my headline. But this is basically a metamorphosis, if I can use that long word, that's been happening for quite a while, Rafe. We've gone through numerous versions of Obby suite, which took over from PC suite. I hope you'll be keeping up at the back. And now we have Nokia suite to keep up with the new name change and Obby, the Obby brand receding into the distance. But there have been quite a few little changes. There's a new support view, which I did screenshot for the news story, which is new and very welcome, and basically summarized on one pane of glass, if you like, the details of your device, its current status, including how, even if it's charging, which is quite nice really, its capacity. You can do backups, restores, and device software updates all from one screen now, along with links for help and support. So you installed this, didn't you?
Yes, I did, and it's, you know, obviously been part of a long process to go from Obby to Nokia, and we've said before it's the right thing. But I think it's worth making the point that over the years, Nokia Suite and previously Obby Suite and PC Suite have actually gone through a lot of iterations. And I think, you know, you see a lot of complaints about it saying it's too big, it's slow, it's whatever. But I'm actually quite impressed with this latest version. It does have a lot of functionality in it without being too complicated. And I think therein is the problem with PC connectivity. People often want a lot of features, but they want simplicity at the same time. And there's kind of these two, you know, wild horses dragging the ideals apart, if you like. And Nokia have, over the years, you know, sometimes got the balance wrong. I can remember when PC Suite required a lot of resources to run on the PC. And to be fair, it still does, but I don't think it's as bad as it used to be. And the stability is pretty good. Don't see too many crashes. So overall, I actually think they're doing a pretty good job here. And when you consider the range of functionality, as you were talking about the support there, but it's also sideloading of maps and various other bits and pieces as well, you know, being able to connect to the internet, sort of the tethering style stuff. It's, you know, a pretty comprehensive job. And I'd actually go as far as to say I think this is one of the better versions of the sort of PC software that comes with a smartphone. Elsewhere, it does tend to sometimes be a big fragmented, you know, iTunes obviously is obviously a big one, but I think people, particularly on the PC, sometimes have issues with that. It's a love-hate relationship. And, you know, I've been using the Zune desktop client for Windows. I know I don't seem to mind too much, but it seems to draw screams of frustration from Steve and some other people I know. So overall, I think actually the fact that people have not completely stopped complaining about Nokia Suite, but they seem to die down, is a pretty good sign.
The biggest problem I have is not necessarily the interface, although I do think Zune Desktop is a bit over the top, really. I mean, Nokia PC Suite hits about the sweet spot. But my biggest bugbear with all of these systems, and that includes Apple's iTunes as well, they all concentrate on trying to sell you stuff, which I guess is understandable because the manufacturers are trying to think, wow, we have an ecosystem, let's try and sell stuff even on the PC connectivity suite. But all I want to do, I plug my phone and I want to do backups and I want to check for updates and so forth. And I'm being bombarded with install this, install that, buy this, buy that. And it just gets some my nerves sometimes, I reckon.
Yeah, well, I think that's partly a result of, you know, it's serving people who've got different use cases, you know, different users. Some people kind of like the idea that they'll be able to see interesting apps and games appear when they're using PC Suite or iTunes or whatever it happens to be. And I guess that diversity of the sort of user base is one of the problems. You have to try and design it so it keeps everybody happy. But inevitably, I think you end up optimizing for the majority. And I think a lot of people listening to this podcast, and I'm sure you fall into this category, see sort of more technical users who just basically, as you say, want it to do the basics in terms of backup, maybe sync, and getting stuff on and off it in a quick and efficient manner. And that often means USB mass storage rather than using the built-in sync tools. And so, you know, the power users, as always, probably a little bit underserved by some of these PC connectivity tools.
Yeah. Okay. And also updated, we have a couple of big firmware updates. I guess the biggest is probably the Nokia X6, which is now, what, a year and a half, getting on for 2 years old. It was Nokia's first capacitive-screened touch-driven phone, following on for the same sort of ethos as the Nokia 5800, with the huge stereo speakers, really loud and impressive, but this time with capacitive screen, which made it kind of an exciting device in a way at the time, and it's still not a bad smartphone to this day. I'm sure Ewan can comment in a moment. This is a whopping 9 megabyte over-the-air upgrade, which is large as over-the-air upgrades go. You get the new browser from Symbian Anna, minus a few twiddles. You get the Ovimaps 3.6, which I know has been out for a few months, but this is a pretty major upgrade to what was originally shipped in the X6. On the whole, the X6 really has come on leaps and bounds with this update. There are some performance updates and bug fixes and so forth. The biggest downside of the X6, of course, is the fact that there's no expansion. You can't stick an extra bigger memory card in, so you're stuck with the 16 gig or 32 gig that it came with. But you've still got one in the household, haven't you? Has that been updated, or are you planning to?
Vicky actually has the X6 now, and it's quite happy for her, so we'll leave the update for the moment on pain of divorce. It really just does typify the X6. I mean, it arrived slightly too early. I remember the initial firmware was one of the most underwhelming firmwares I'd ever seen. I think I remember throwing it away in disgust on a National Express bus after 40 minutes of the MP3 player and returning to an old iPod Shuffle that I had lurking at the bottom of the bag. It was that bad. But the firmware's improved this over time, and it became my smartphone of choice for a good 8 or 9 months. It was a delightful little size. The capacitive screen, it still looks gorgeous. It still has this still an incredibly small form factor as well, with a replaceable battery, good long life, and those speakers have not been rivaled. I mean, I remember looking at the alleged replacment,
the X7,
the X7, which had four speaker grills, but only one speaker. It was still in mono. I think, and I'm sure somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, I think this has been the last Symbian handset with stereo speakers.
Well, in theory, the X7 has stereo speakers. It's just that they're mounted together and they're pointing inside the plastics. They might as well be mono.
No, Steve, now I'm going to correct you on this when we check this. The Hollies' Jennifer Eccles is a mono recording remastered into stereo that has all the vocals on the left track and all the music on the right track, and you can only hear the music on the X7 when you go to a mono track. It is a mono phone.
Okay, I bow to your superior audio expertise. But yes, the Nokia 5800 had the same speakers, but that was kind of the first generation.
That was before the X.
Yeah, the music-centric. Then we had the X6, which were improved in that with the capacitive screen, and really was quite a nice phone. It also had a much better camera, by the way. And then, yes, you're quite right, since then, we haven't seen anything with a really, really decent set of stereo speakers. I mean, the one that was cancelled, the Rafe, the 600, that had a pretty good speaker system, didn't it?
Yes, but again, I think it was a mono speaker. It was just a very loud speaker. And I think I'm right in saying the 603 has now inherited that.
Okay, so yes, you're absolutely right. This X6 has still really got a place in history and a place in people's pockets, I reckon.
Yeah. And
I think we're both across properties there. I'm just looking back at the pictures and going, oh, I remember that phone. It was really nice. And it still is really nice. and that's the thing. It was also 32 gig onboard storage. I mean, that's stuff that we're still clamoring for nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. So I reckon the X6 is still a valid device. I snaffled myself one up on eBay. It was a nice little white and blue model for about £90 a few months back, and I'm still very, very pleased with that. And I still go back to it every now and then and mull using it for a day or two just to appreciate what it can do and to hear my music and my podcast in glorious bassy stereo. Very nice indeed. Also updated this week, again, quite a major device, very well-respected device, is the E72, and David's got the update details.
Yes, there's not as much to report as the X6, I'm afraid. The E72 has now been upgraded to version 81, or 81.003 if you want to be really precise. It was only a 1.2 megabyte update, and the version numbers after I performed the update, Web had been updated to version 7.3.1.32. Email was at 3.21, although that gets independent updates, so it may vary from device to device. And we had a strange thing, but after the update, it probably wasn't changed, but QuickOffice was actually a lower version number than you had on your version 71 E72, Steve. So, But there's no other noticeable differences in performance, so I suspect this was just bug updates and perhaps maybe some security tweaks as well. So, like I said, not much to report, but it is available over the air, at least to one of our E72s, i.e. mine, so it should be coming to an E72 near you soon.
I'm jealous, because I thought mine was a SIM-free device, and again, Nokia's variant system just seemed to be confusing various people, and it does seem to take a disappointingly long time for these little updates to roll out from device to device. But yes, I'm actually waiting for that. Ray, if you had a comment.
Yeah, it's just to say that this is, yes, it is one of the smaller security and bug fix updates. Nokia have actually said recently that they will continue to do these for the older devices when they have been what they sort of euphemistically term popular devices. So something like the E72 obviously sold in more numbers than some of the other Symbian devices, so we'll continue to see updates for that. The X6 one, it's just worth mentioning very briefly that this was kind of the standard update that quite a few of these S65th edition or Symbian 1 devices received to bring it the browser up to date and some of the services up to date. And the X6 just took a little bit longer to get there because it had some additional technical challenges to overcome, I understand. I suspect probably related to the memory and the sort of screen configuration. But it's good to see that that's finally got there as well, because as you all said, the X6 is got a sort of special place in my heart as being one of the first capacitive screens on Nokia, which I think it was about time too. And of course, now we're all on capacitive screens for pretty much every Nokia smartphone.
Yeah, I think I rather horrified you. We met up with one of the guys from a couple of guys from Nokia a month or so back, Rafe, and I turned up proudly with my year and a half old white and blue X6, and everybody else had cutting edge devices, and there was me with an X6 on the table. I felt rather cool in a sort of retro way.
But that's actually a very important point there, Steve. You know, we have to remember that while we're sitting here, we're talking about the latest devices, the X7s and so on. You know, a year and a half back isn't that long in smartphone history. Most people are on two-year contracts. The majority of people won't immediately upgrade at the end of those 2 years. They'll carry on until they see something nice in the shops and go into a month-to-month rolling contract. The fact that the X6 is still being supported 18 months down the line shouldn't be something that we cheer about, although we will. It should be something that's expected.
That's right, and the X6 is still being sold in some countries as a brand new handset as well. So I think it's one of the things we do try and do on All About Symbian is mention some of these older devices from time to time when we can. Obviously, firmware updates are one of the big ones, but you'll have seen Steve's article sort of pimping my device X, Y, or Z. And, you know, that really is about kind of supporting some of the older devices, because on a, you know, I think the average now in the UK is about 20 months for people owning a device. That's how long they keep it. It's slightly less long than the contract length of 2 years, because obviously some people are on 18-month or 12-month contracts or just buy handsets on a regular basis. But even so, I think the vast majority of people are now probably on 18-month or two-year contracts, and that's their update cycle.
Absolutely. There's still a place in my heart for some of these old devices. I'm still waiting for the firmware update to my N93, by the way. Nokia, if you're out there, I still want my version 30 for the N93 from 2006. But there we go. Now, it's been update week this week on All About Symbian and the Symbian world in general. Nokia Maps 3.8 has now got a formal release. This was the one that with all that broke it down into different components and made it easier to install, but also added some bits around the edges, which we talked about in a previous podcast. Nokia Maps 3.8 now formally released, but only for the Symbian Belle devices so far. But you rest assured that we're keeping an eye on that. And possibly by the time you even hear this podcast, it might be out for the Anna devices as well. Rafe, obviously I've been playing with this. You had a bit play with 3.8 as well. Is it really worthwhile waiting for?
Yes, I would say it would be. I enjoyed using this one in beta, and it's kind of been my main Maps solution. I will confess I kept a couple of devices on the kind of the formal stable release as well, just in case. But I was running this, I think, on the E6 and the N8 as well, and I, you know, had no problems really during the beta. And this full version, or the release version, presumably has added a bit more stability. And unlike a lot of people, I actually liked the sort of the modular breakdown. It made a lot of sense to me, because it was sort of a decision, I'm going to be doing this, so I just dive into this. And you're able to find everything much more quickly. But also, you know, just some of the performance updates are worthwhile as well. And, you know, Nokia Maps has come on an incredibly long way. I mean, the functionality within it is really quite rich now. I mean, people talk about the comparison to something like Google Maps or some of the other solutions on competing platforms. I do actually think Nokia Maps is a significant distance ahead now, but it's not just the base features like the, you know, being able to preload maps, because to a certain extent you're getting that elsewhere now as well, but it's just in terms of the performance of the routing tends to be very, very good now. Now, I will preface all those remarks by saying it does depend what country you're in, because obviously that has a effect on the quality of both the mapping and the routing information. But certainly in the UK, if I was going to choose a mapping solution, I wouldn't hesitate to pick Nokia Maps as my preferred option. And 3.8 is the latest iteration. Yes, it takes a while to get used to the new layout if you like the old one, but for me it was a positive change, not a negative one.
Self into a bit of a twist, really. I, having installed the beta, I then thought, well, how on earth am I going to tell when it gets released? Because the update is possibly going to tell me. It'll get confused by the fact that I've already got 3.8 from the beta. So I thought, well, I'll try removing it. But of course, with this component-based installer, you have to go into the Settings Application Manager, and there's about 15 different blitted modules to uninstall one by one. And even then, when you've done that, you then find that Maps isn't on your device at all and doesn't show up in any screens. So you've then got to find a downloader for it. You go into the Obvious store and it says Maps already installed. You think, no, it's not. I can't see the icon anywhere. So in the end, I had to use the slash download trick from the Obvious store on the desktop, find the SIS file, download the SIS file, sideload it. It's all rather a pain, but then there's such is life on the beta cutting edge. But there we go. I got it working in the end, and I should be able to tell when 3.8 gets the formal release, because it will pop up in SW Update, which is probably where most people listening to this will find it.
Yes, we should just make it clear that the release that we're talking about here is actually for the Bell devices only, but we expect it to come out for the Anna devices in the next few days. And before we move on to the last bit of the podcast, just to talk about one more update that's come out this week, and that's the Qt 4.7.4 bundle for Symbian. It's really the version that's actually running on Symbian Bell being made available for the Symbian One device or the Symbian Anna devices. There are quite a few updates in here, but one of the more important ones is the fact that the Qt Quick Components 1.1 for Symbian have been updated. So that just means there's a few more widgets, a bit more stability around, so that you can get some extra features in the applications. So one of those is better support for a split view keyboard in sort of editing. And there's also some new icon related stuff to the new Bell UI notification screen. There's also much better support for NFC and Bluetooth, so when you're dealing with those in your applications, this new version of Qt, which is, as I say, it's a relatively large update, although I don't think the functionality will make any massive differences to applications. So developers who want to get this can go over to qt.nokia.com and download it. They should actually get it automatically delivered through the update mechanism available through the SDK, but it's just one that's worth noting, is we'll probably see some extra bits come into some of the sort of rapidly updating applications taking advantage of these the new widgets in the Qt Quick Components 1.1. So it's good to see that this continues to get updated, and it's continuing to improve the developer environment for the Symbian 3 devices. So despite the fact that a lot of the attention has been elsewhere at the moment, there's actually still a lot of activity going around in the Symbian world. And I think all of these updates just go to prove that. And Nokia, you know, seems to be doing a very good job of keeping things rolling along.
I think it's also fair to say that back in the early days of Qt, maybe 6 months ago, people were having all sorts of problems with Qt runtimes misbehaving or things going missing or programs not installing. And we thought, this is just a nightmare. Why do they ever bother going down the Qt road? But I have to say, in the last 2 or 3 months, everything that's been Qt related is just installed like a dream, grabbed the components as it's needed to, and I haven't had a single problem. So I think the Qt world really is maturing now, and it's got a stage where you can wholeheartedly recommend it to other people. Well, yes, Qt apps are something to go for, and don't be afraid of them.
Yeah, that's right. The smart installer, they seem to have worked out many of the kinks. I was just looking back at the poster on this, and actually there's one more feature that's worth mentioning that I'd encourage developers to go and play with, and that's the fact that it now supports TV out mode, and actually letting you have a different layout showing on the TV screen that's actually showing on the phone. So I'm sure there's potential for some pretty interesting types of applications there, you know, having a control mechanism for what's going on the TV screen, or doing high resolutions on the devices that support HDMI out. So developers, go and explore that. I know it was possible in Symbian C++ before now, but with Qt it's probably a lot more accessible than it was before.
Yeah. Just casting your minds back to Nokia World, guys, this is something I wanted to chat about. But over in the corner on the upper level was a big white tent, which is where Stephen Elop was sleeping for the night because he couldn't get a hotel. No, it wasn't. There was a big, big white tent, which is Nokia's future technology tent. And during the 2 days, various things were showcased there. I didn't actually spot Rafe, but they actually shuffled the exhibits around from day to day. And I only turning up to get a snapshot of them with David. I think we just caught some of the items, not all of them, which is disappointing. But I just want to go around the panel. I mean, David, you've been writing these up very, very splendidly for our two sites. What do you want to start with? What really caught your eye as something outstanding? Standing for the future?
I think the one that was most popular on other sites was the flexible devices, so let's start with that. When we went up to the Future Tech tent, we spoke to Nokia's Tapani Droitman, the Nokia's head of design technology insights, and I apologize for slaughtering your name. he was manning the centerpiece demo, which had a future Nokia device, which was a bendable phone. And the idea is that you could bend and twist instead of touching the screen. And he was saying there are times in which having to touch a capacitive screen is not advantageous, and it would actually be easier to physically manipulate the device, such as environments where you have to wear heavy gloves. And I think, as I said in my article, I think that applies more to Finland than Silicon Valley. But as I said, there was bending and twisting, which were replacement gestures for what we normally do on the screen. So for example, bending one way would select items, and then say if you're going through photos, you bend to select a photo, and then you can bend in or bend out to zoom in or out. You can twist the device to scroll through a list, and it actually has a linear response to how much you are deforming the device. So the harder you twist or bend, the faster the reaction. Now, the device itself, it did have a functional bendable screen, but that's all it had in terms of the electronics, because anyone who's been looking at the photos of this device very carefully will see that there was a big umbilical cable going into the demonstration stand below. So there's obviously a computer hidden away running the whole thing.
However, not sure other sites, David, actually spotted the fact that that wasn't actually a device. I'm sure some of the people reporting it thought that was an actual prototype bendy phone, where in actual fact it was almost patently just a prototype screen, and all the gubbins was underneath. It wasn't just a security or power tether. That was the tether providing everything.
Well, and ironically, I think some of the same sites actually had photos showing the umbilical cable. So, but what actually makes this possible is actually, there's a little bit I'm missing. I'll go back to you. I think you asked the panel, Steve. You're saying, well, when this is actually a fully fledged phone, how are you going to have reliable electronics inside while you're still bending it? Are we going to have terrible reliability problems? And his answer was that he whipped out another non-functional mock-up device, which I've since seen has been called a Nokia Human. But it was basically saying that the electronics will be stored in little interlinked islands, which will flex relative to each other like a watch strap. And in the future, that these devices will be pressure sensitive as well. So, for example, you could answer the phone by squeezing it in your fist. So I'm not sure what happens if you're sitting on it in your pocket.
Yeah, I just to add in, I actually saw the early prototypes of that when I visited the Nokia Research Labs in Cambridge, and it was really quite amazing because it was circuit boards printed on what's effectively a rubbery-like material that can then deform in multiple dimensions. And as you say, it's kind of like overlapping islands. And also, obviously, it's very different to the traditional circuit board, which is very much solid and, you know, quite liable to be broken if you start bending it or doing anything like that to it. So it's, in terms of the practicality, actually the technology is already there. Obviously there are some cost issues involved in doing it in mass production way, but it's absolutely possible to actually build this device with the current technology. It's really just about the cost issues, as I say, and yes, I'm sure there are still reliability issues to be worked out, but it was interesting. I mean, I saw this as well. It was just amazing to actually see something that's been talked about, you know, so many times, actually getting that little bit closer to fruition.
Go on, Steve.
I was going to say, I'm still rather sceptical, though, as the long-term reliability of devices. But anybody who's had any experience whatsoever of devices with moving parts in the PDA and phone world over the last 20 years, like me and you and Rafe probably, and maybe your good self, we've known that the more things move, the more things twist, the more things bend, the more things break. And so I remain a healthy, twisting and bending sceptic.
Yeah, Scion hinges, everyone.
Yeah. Now, hold on a second. Scion's big problem wasn't the hinge. Scion's big problem was in that ribbon cable. They put a little hole right in the middle of the ribbon cable as a mounting pin, and that seriously weakened that flexi part. I mean, let's remember, that is the exception to the rule. I put lots of money in the bucket there. But the problems that the Scion had with the flexi screen cable should not be related into something like the E90 or any of the other clamshell stuff, and especially the E7. I mean, that's been open and closed and slammed by me huge amounts of times in the last year. So let's be careful that we don't extrapolate the wrong data.
Okay. Perfect. Do carry on, David.
Well, there was another demo at the side of a tent which actually explained the technology of how the device could actually read input by physical deformation. And this is actually working on carbon nanotube technology. And what the idea is that carbon nanotubes are, for those who don't know, here's a little science class. You have a sheet of graphene, which is a sheet of carbon atoms, which is arranged in a hexagonal pattern. So it's one atom thick. And you wrap that into a tube and bond it. So you have just like a tube constructed of carbon atoms. And these tubes and their electrical properties change when they're under tension. So bending or twisting a device that is coated in carbon nanotubes will naturally put them under tension. And there was a little demo showing that there was like a clamp, two clamps that were moving relative to each other by 5% of the initial spacing, and they were holding a nanotube and reading its electrical resistance, and that was controlling the zoom level of a map that was on a computer monitor above. So I think that goes nicely into another demo that was running it, because do you remember the hydrophobic coating, Steve?
Yeah, that this is kind of more relevant, I guess, to immediately to the phones coming out in the next year or so. I mean, we've already got phones with oleophobic screens. I mean, I think it's the C7 and the 701, Wraith, they've both got some sort of special coating on to resist fingerprints. And here we're talking about something that can not only resist fingerprints, but can actively resist water, not mechanically, but chemically. So, you know, raindrops just slide off it. And if they coated presumably all the joints and the ports and the hinges and various other the weak points, then basically the phone would be near as damn it waterproof just by applying a special coating.
And the other advantage of that technology is that it's actually looking as if they can use it as a replacement for current touchscreen technology. Capacitive screens, they use a range of materials for the conductors, but one conductor they use is called indium tin oxide, which is a transparent conductor. And indium is becoming increasingly rare scarce in the world, and it's expensive to extract it because the group of chemicals it belongs to is the rare earth metals, so the clue is in the name.
So you can't get it down the supermarket then?
Absolutely not. It would be an amazing supermarket if you could. because of the electrical properties of carbon nanotubes, what we do, we actually put a mesh of nanotubes above the screen but leave a very microscopic air gap, and this creates an electrical capacitor. And when water is sitting on top, that modifies the capacitance of the air gap, which can be read off as input. So what they still need to do is adapt that so that it'll react to the oils in human skin, so you can react to human touch. But that is all based on carbon, which is one of the most abundant elements on the planet. So it's going to make screens a lot easier it's going to make it easy to obtain the material, so it's going to be less mining needed, and it's going to make things a lot cheaper as well.
Yeah, we should just add, after David has put on his professor hat here and given us the detailed science technical explanation, for those who are maybe less science inclined, the cool bit of this demo was the fact that you dropped a bit of water onto this surface. Normally when a droplet of water hits the surface, it kind of spreads out, and this was all shown on a really quite impressive high speed camera. What it almost does is it does spread out initially, but then it's hydrophobic means water fearing, for those that don't know. There's a droplet kind of reforms into a round drop on where it first hit the surface, and obviously that then becomes a lot easier to brush off. So it's kind of, you know, it doesn't spread out, it can't get into everything like it normally does. So while it's not exactly waterproof, it's not something you could probably drop into a glass of water or anything like that, it is very much splash proof, so you know, using it out in the rain you wouldn't have any problems there. And actually I suspect if you dropped a glass of water or something like that across it, it would probably survive, or the survival rating would go up significantly. So this is one of those cases where it's a really quite interesting bit of science, but has a really cool end effect in terms of the durability and the survivability of devices. And actually, you know, seeing the demo, you sort of go, ooh, that's clever. And you know, pardon me, the scientist in me goes, oh, that's really clever how it works, but so other bit of me just goes, ooh, shiny, that's clever. But it's really nice to see. What I thought was a lot of these Nokia Research Lab demos, you sometimes go, yeah, when's that going to make it into the shops, or when are we going to see that on a device? It's sort of a bit difficult to get that. I do remember a while back seeing some of the sensor demos for things like accelerometers, and they did come in time, to be fair. But this is one that feels like actually it could be with us pretty rapidly, and I suspect most people will never notice it on their device, but it's a really nice bit of innovation. And I thought the whole tent there at Nokia World was absolutely fascinating. They did a really great job showcasing their efforts, which sometimes doesn't get as much praise as it deserves.
Yeah, and we've been writing all these up in a series of articles, cross-posted to all of the All About sites, mainly written by David, so well done for that. But do go and read them, and with some nice shiny photographs by myself just to illustrate them and keep you appraised of what Nokia is up to, and let's hope not too many trade secrets slipped out to their various competitors. And the one final thing I wanted to mention from the future tent before we finish this podcast, as we got Ewan Spence back on, and he's the guy who into music and media, was their director's cut demo. Now, I'll just explain this briefly, Ewan, and then maybe you can give us your verdict. But basically, they equipped a load of people at the Nokia party on day one, end of day one, with the E7s and N8s, with this special video capture software that basically separated out the audio track and tagged it with accelerometer data. So basically they then at the end of the party gathered all the devices up and they spat it all into a huge piece of software which analyzed the audio tracks and then analyzed the accelerometer data and basically stitched all people's videos of the event, of people, of acts, and into one seamless whole, cutting and splicing as if it was a director splicing between different bits of video footage from live camera, you know, professional cameras. Now, obviously, the footage was all amateur, but it was actually all very seamlessly done, and you could not spot, in terms of the audio track, exactly where the, you know, where the cuts occurred, and there was nothing that was truly disruptive. Now, my biggest problem is that in a real event, a real-life situation, Nokia developed this, they'll have it as a public service, and people say they go to a party at, you know, Glastonbury or something, they'll upload their bits, and their friends will upload their bits, and you get 20 different people all uploading their snatches of Radiohead performing in their primetime slot, and there'll be bits missing, because there'll be everyone shot the middle bit, and the guitar solo, and the verse two will be completely missing, and the intro will be there, but the bit after the intro be missing because no one will have covered it, and I'll have big gaps in the performance. Did you get a chance to see this, Ewan, and what was your verdict on how practical the technology will be?
Well, first of all, if you miss a verse two choruses in the middle bit from a Radiohead, can you tell the difference?
That is a good point.
You know, I didn't get to hear this. Is actually the first to be hearing this. It sounds absolutely wonderful. But two things immediately spring to mind. The first one is it reminds me very much of Ray Charles. I remember the story that when he was on the set of the Blues Brothers, that he would just hold a microphone up in the air and just leave it there for 5 or 10 minutes. And it was a stereo microphone. And when people asked him why, he says, well, I can go back, I can put this tape on, put on a pair of headphones, and it's like I'm there again. Because, obviously, of course, that was his primary input source and it was copying that. It really worries me what somebody like Michael Bay could do with this sort of technology. But at the same time, I mean, concerts and wonderful there. There's a huge amount of people that when they go to a live gig still experience it through a mobile phone screen. And so this is, think we have to move on a bit here, Steve. I think, you know, we have to put the fact that, you know, going to Glastonbury, getting out your tent and actually watching the show is something that only old people do nowadays. Nowadays, people go there and everybody films it. I don't think we'll have the situation where you will miss a bit of a Radiohead. If somebody's at a Radiohead concert, they're fans, they'll do the whole thing. They'll have two phones with them to make sure they capture the same performances. I mean, can you imagine something like, say a Grand Prix? You think of the huge numbers of people that you have in the grandstands that literally line the tracks of these Grand Prix. They all capture video. Now, right now, the FIA pull them all off YouTube. But if they were to capture that and actually do a film, I mean, the footage that you would get would be far in excess of what you get on the TV. You wouldn't miss a single moment. I mean, I actually have a more commercial worry about this, which is if you go to a gig, if you submit that video, if you put it up, you know, it's not going to be like when you were at the Led Zeppelin reunion gig. Jeff Pulver recorded that on his handset, put a little clip up on YouTube, got a call the next day, not to ask for him to take it down, but to ask if they could use it on the DVD release. You're not going to get that with something like this. There's going to be, you buy the ticket, you give us the footage, and we'll exploit it ourselves. And if you'd like to see what happened, you can buy the DVD yourself. You know, the problem with crowdsourcing is, how do you reward a crowd? You know, so from a technical point of view, it's wonderful. You know, you can do that with computers. From a practical point of view, from a human point of view, it's very thin edge of the wedge. But there again, that's what all experimental stuff should be.
Yeah. So I also worry about the sheer numbers and the bandwidth required. People may not realize this, but on most modern phones, even with 720p recording, you're talking of 100 megabytes per minute of footage. So if you've recorded that aforementioned Radiohead song, even in its entirety, there's 7 minutes, that's 700 megabytes. And you think, okay, I'm going to upload that to the Nokia Director's Cut site and with my friends, and we'll put together a mix. But is each of you really going to sit there uploading 700 megabytes, even over Wi-Fi? That's going to be a huge, huge pain. So I worry about the practicality of this, but I was very impressed by how seamlessly it was all pulled together. And there's definitely potential there and food for thought. So again, do go and read the articles on All About Symbian and All About Windows Phone, which in itself is a good moment to finish. Could plug in our different sites, Rafe. AllaboutWindowsPhone.com is very much up and running now, isn't it? And doing well?
Yes, it is doing well. We just published the first part of our Lumia 800 review. So if you're interested in the Windows Phone device, go and have a look at that. But of course, also don't forget to visit allaboutsymbian.com as you always do. And that's at AAS on Twitter and allaboutsymbian.com/Facebook on Facebook. Facebook.com/allaboutsymbian, I should say.
Yeah, and my review of the Nokia 700, which is the first Symbian Bell handset we've had in our hands, that is now complete if you go and look on the site. So all three review parts, just over 6,000 words in all, and lots of photos and screenshots. Do go and read that. The Nokia 701, I believe, is about to be in the house, Rafe.
Yes, that's right. It should be turning up today, I hope, and we'll have a review on that starting next week.
Yeah. Rafe's voice sounds like it's completely going. He's got some busy meetings later on as well. So we're going to let everybody go. And thank you very much indeed for listening. We will catch you next week on the podcast. In the meantime, it's goodbye from Rafe.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye from David.
Goodbye.
And a goodbye from Ewan.
And goodbye.